And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hey, everybody, this is Phil Lernis coming at you from Los Angeles, California, and down under, that's Dean Haglund. Hello, Dean Haglund.
Hey, Phil Lernis, I'm down under.
Yeah, well, good. Well spoken, well stated. This is a special installment of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour in that we might try to actually have it be an hour or less. Let's see if we can make that happen.
Okay.
As opposed to last week's 80-minute installment. I mean, I think maybe my plan now is we could just take every fourth week off because we're doing 20 minutes extra every show.
Right, just cut those in.
Today, and the reason is because we spend so much time bullshitting at the top. All right, today is a special theme show that we've discussed for a while now. Our top 10 all-time favorite action films.
Right. Now, of course, there's always stipulations. And we always, you know, have caveats off the top of any of our top tens. So for you, capsulize what is included in your thesis and what's excluded.
It's mostly about it's mostly what's excluded. And I realize in our opening title song, we excluded something. So let me see if I can alleviate or correct that error right now.
Top 10.
Thank you, Garrett Watley. Had to have him say top 10. All right.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, my God.
So I have on my list, if you could see the paper that I'm looking at, you would see that in bold, underlined, all caps, it says top 10 action films. Then beneath it, a subheading, bold, all caps, why not? And these are the ones that are not in it that I was asking, why aren't they in it?
Why not? Why not this movie, I say?
So this hopefully will come with why they're excluded. It's not honorable mention, per se. I don't have an honorable mention. But I did have films that I excluded, and I thought we would talk about maybe why. The Magnificent Seven from 1960. Okay?
Right.
I don't have it because I realized, you know what? It was on my Westerns list. And
right.
And the reason it would have been on was because I wanted to represent Westerns. But we've already done our top 10 Westerns, and many of them were there in no small part because of their action.
Right.
But I wanted this to be a standalone list that tries to identify, is there something we can call the action genre? And if there
right.
is, yes, of course, like with science fiction, there will be genre crossovers, and something can be more than one genre. There can be a comedy Western, for example, with Blazing Saddles. Oh, by the way, I even like the action in that movie. But if there is something that is an action genre, I wanted this to be a standalone episode. So no Westerns in it. Likewise,
right.
I did not include a movie that, since we've been doing this show, I have called one of the best recent action films when it came out, and it drove me nuts that more people weren't seeing it, and that was the Oscar-winning Best Picture, The Hurt Locker. I thought that was
right.
an extraordinary action film, and people said it's an action film, but it's, and then the, whatever would come out of their mouth next was basically, but it's good, right? Like, like an action film
right.
couldn't be good. But as we have discussed before, we are going to do a list in the near future of our top 10 war films. So again,
exactly.
I want this to be a standalone. Some of the ones that could have made it but didn't. Children of Men.
See, that shows up as one of my favorite, as it's on our sci-fi list. But to me, rewatching it, It's sort of him walking through action.
Yes, he's first point. He's not an action protagonist. It might be an action film, but he is not an action protagonist. He is either walking through it or from it, seeking to flee it. Everything he does is to remove himself from the action.
Right. So therefore, I'm like, well, that's kind of cheating calling that an action film.
Well, and I would say then it leads to a climax where it is resolved not through action, but through peace, through non-action.
Right.
The resolution does not find itself through action. And I would say, if nothing else, that has to be true for it to be an action film. The story must be resolved through action.
Right. Exactly.
So, yes, so. I had thought, because of the wonderful action sequences in it, what film has better action sequences? Maybe none, but indeed not an action film. Some of the others, recent vintage, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol has some action sequences in it that I absolutely love. And I do think it's a very, very good film. But do I hold against it the fact that it took them four films before they finally made a really good movie in that series? Yes, I do. And it's not like the action sequences in that are necessarily more stellar or more memorable than even in the first one. It's just that they don't have any bad ones like the first one does. So I held that against it. Aliens is a beloved action franchise, and of course the first Aliens movie by Jim Cameron, really introducing Ripley as an action heroine. Maybe the first, as far as I know, the first mainstream studio picture to do that. 70s films, there were women who were the leads in action movies, but I think they were independents, they were exploitation films, they were drive-in films, not major studio releases. Right. So a great movie with great action, a great character, and here's the however. However, I think by turning it into an action franchise, that was a shift from which the series never recovered, and as a result, we're still trying to get back to a film as good as the original Alien, and it's a frustrated effort because these movies have to be thought-provoking science fiction, horror, and action. And you know what?
Right.
The three of those things are very unwieldy to mix together. So I blame Aliens for making a shift that hurt, ironically, the storytelling possibilities of that universe.
You just argued for the fact that that makes it a great action film.
No, I said that it might be a great action film, but it ruined the series. And I hold that against it. I hold that against it. It's my list. I get to say why not. I get to say why not.
It's on my list too, though, but I'm arguing.
It's not on my list. So you can have.
Mine,
well, you don't have to reveal that right now. We're talking about what's excluded. Well, this is what's excluded. The category of you. One thing you cannot do is include your titles on the included list in the excluded list. These are my excluded films, and I'm almost done with them. I'm almost done with them because you might talk about some of these, and you can tell me why they're on your list. But this is why. Right. So Star Wars, not on my list. And the reason is, even though it changes everything, and even though we could say that it's an action film, when I watch it, I believe when people watch it, they don't watch it for the action anymore. That's not why they watch it. We watch it for the mythology, for the themes, maybe for the characters. Mm-hmm. But it's not for the action sequences. And finally, one of my all-time favorite action films, I do believe it's in an action genre, it's Big Trouble in Little China by John Carpenter. But I love it for the comedy, and I love it for the fact that it plays best as a parody of films that weren't even made yet. It was anticipating what Hong Kong films would become and how Hollywood would import those Hong Kong films and reinvent them. It, like I said, plays as a wonderful parody of movies that weren't made yet. And if it had come out at the time of The Matrix 15 years later, It would have been a huge, huge hit. But these are the films not included. These are the great films excluded from my list. What did you exclude and why?
Well, let's see. I got a couple there. I excluded, and to my mind, this is more action than a war movie, but Black Hawk Down teetered for a long time on my list because this is the story of the Battle of Mogadishu. However, the action is mostly guys trapped and, you know, getting out of a Mogadishu situation. So for my mind,
the old Mogadishu situation.
That's what we call it here in Australia. So that never made the list.
But I would say, again, it is a war film. It is a war film. So
it feels more like an action film. I guess, then we go to what my caveats are for what makes a war film. And that's a whole nother bag.
That'll be another show. Okay. But so you have two reasons why it's not on the list. All right.
Right. Yeah. Because my list, what I'm looking for in my action films are a sense of humor, action driving story. You know, that each scene itself has a beginning, middle, and end, which I always love.
So this action driving story, you know, I always say story comes from character. And this is why Hurt Locker is to me an action film, because the revelation of character is explored through action. However, it is also definitely a war film because it really does let us know what fighting situations are like in these modern conflicts. So he's a man of action. He's an action protagonist, but I characterize it first as a war film, and as such, you might be hearing about it later. So what else do you look for in the action film then?
Well, and I also, I like my action, my stunts to be practical as opposed to be CGI phenomena. So, for instance, 300, the Spartan War, as much as its action, feels very much like a computer animated CGI green screen exercise in the latest of Silicon Technologies, and so it didn't make my list.
And when you say Silicon Technologies, you just mean Gerard Butler's pecs.
See what you did there? Awesome. And then, of course, you know, some like really teetering was Steve McQueen's 1968 Bullet, that thriller. But of course, then the action is basically the car chase through San Francisco. And the rest of the movie is kind of just character development up to that, and then the accident afterwards. So
yeah, I mean, I think this idea, the set pieces don't make it an action film,
right?
No matter how good they are. But also there are times, are there not, when the set pieces also don't ruin it as an action movie. I mean, like, there are a couple of films that came close to my list. We'll talk about one maybe in a little while. But the action is kind of what kept it off the list, in that it's a great action movie because it's a great movie, but the action sequences themselves don't necessarily hold up to modern scrutiny. What might be an example of this? An example of this might be something like North by Northwest. A case could be made that that's an action film, right? But I'm not sure that, for example, the crop duster sequence plays for a contemporary audience the way it did for an older audience. But the movie itself is still a huge amount of fun. But a lot of it's the cat and mouse stuff, not the action stuff.
Grace Kelly or Cary Grant.
Or maybe more Eva Marie Saint, since she's the one in the film and not Grace Kelly.
Yeah. But Eva Marie Saint is what I meant.
There you go. But the stunt that Eva Marie Saint does in pulling off the fact that you believe she's Grace Kelly is undeniably brilliant action. All right. Are you ready to get to number 10 on your list?
Yes, let's do it.
What is it?
Oh, I'm starting. Yes. Oh, this is why it takes more than an hour to do these things.
It serves me right for asking you a yes/no question. You did answer the question. Are you ready? Yeah. And that was the question, and you said yes. But what is it?
Okay. Here we go. I thought maybe there was a musical sting or something. No.
I don't. I didn't prepare much for this because I'm hitting the road again. Unfortunately, I don't have clips of anything, so it's just us talking and talking and talking. And so, what's number 10?
Well, we don't need clips because you want to see the action. We tell people go see these movies. Okay. My number 10, of course, the worst titled of all of these. I prefer to know it as Live, Die, Repeat, but Tom Cruise's Edge of Tomorrow, where the Marine who has to die and come back, he's got the disease the aliens have, and he can relive the same battle sequence over and over again to get past it, to finally defeat it. I thought this was an action film, the nonstop. I mean, what a great way to just have almost constant action is just to allow the character to die and then come back, get to the battle sequence again and do it all over again. It's kind of a clever trick in the screenplay to have the most amount of action possible crammed into a movie.
Well, it also does a couple of nifty tricks because a lot of viewers go to video games for their action thrills, right? And it's the closest movie, I think, to actually being a video game experience, because you die and then you can reboot the game, but you're rebooted now a little bit stronger because you've learned something about the game through how you died. So the audience gets to kind of play along as this rebooted video game player. But also as story, it's an exciting way to interpret the action genre because the character is being revealed and refined through action, but not just certain survival skills and fighting skills are getting improved. He's getting smarter. He's getting better at dealing with people. He's becoming a better person through all of this because he has to. So it's follow me on this. What's kind of cool about it is it's a first-person shooter game meets Bill Murray's Groundhog Day.
That's right. I hadn't thought of that, but that's true because he actually develops a relationship with Emily Blunt. There is an improvement, altruism that develops throughout all these battles.
You might want to see, I haven't seen it, you might want to see the new Tom Cruise film. It was released there a long time before it was released here, but it's called American Maid. And it's about Tom Cruise, I think based on a true story about a CIA pilot or a pilot flying illegal operations for the CIA. But it's from Doug Liman, who directed Live, Die, Repeat.
Oh.
And it got very much the same reviews and the same audience scores as Edge of Tomorrow. So it might be one that you would like to watch and compare and see how that team pulled this story off.
I would like to see that.
American Maid. My number 10, I talked about it this year. I said it may very well be one of the five greatest action films of all time, and it might be, but it's checking in at number 10 because, you know, I always want to be cautious of giving too much weight to something that hasn't had the chance to stand the test of time, right? It's from director Chad Stahelski, who co-directed the first one. Yes, I'm starting with a sequel. Characters created by Derek Kolstad, who again wrote the script for this one. It's John Wick 2. And it feels like part two of the Dollars trilogy, for a few dollars more. And indeed, they've announced they're going to do a third one. So I'm hoping that that will even open up the world more, a la The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So it has very much these overtones of the Dollars trilogy, of The Man with No Name. Keanu Reeves has become the closest thing screen has had to prime era Clint Eastwood action star, in that he eschews dialogue. It's really about presence, which he has in spades, and in terms of action bona fides, which again Keanu Reeves has. And while at the same time, what's wonderful about it and what you would love about it is it takes all its direct cues from the silent film comedies of Buster Keaton.
It certainly does, and I enjoyed this movie. I saw it on the plane, I guess. But for my taste, Volume 1 felt paced better. Sleepy on a 14-hour flight, this thing was not doing it for me.
But
I thought this...
That's true, though, of also Fistful of Dollars. That's the best paced of the three Dollars trilogies, which get longer and get opened up. Why this one, right, to me is better is that the character becomes more interesting, and it gets revealed more, and the world becomes more interesting. They open this world up. And I love that a film gets a bigger budget. And how do they spend that money? Location, location, location. It's not just New York. It's global. And we get what we want from it. We get the, if we're going to Italy, we get the locations we want. We get the fashions we want. They didn't make it bigger, louder, faster. In fact, they might have made it, like you said, a little slower and quieter. But they give us much more of a worldview and a universe to explore. So I think they took the story and made it more interesting.
Fascinating. Okay. Well, then this is brings us to our argument of Aliens, my number nine.
Number nine, Aliens. All right.
You're saying that by screwing up the whole schmeal, by unwieldily putting action, horror, and sci-fi, thoughtful sci-fi, into one movie that James Cameron did, that then is a detriment to the movie as opposed to a celebration of it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll make a specific for you.
And then I'll make a specific for you.
But one of the things that you love and you've pointed out, right, like about the original Alien, the reveal scene when it comes through John Hurt's chest, right? Is how like the other actors in the set didn't know what was going to happen. They just thought they were having a dining scene, and the way they're eating and interacting is some of the best acting you'll ever see, right? You really, you've brought this scene up before, but you really buy that they're, you know, Harry Dean Stanton, Yaphet Kotto, that these guys are wage slaves working in the hulls of these ships. You really buy it. And that's what makes the terror so horrifying, is because we really believe these are real people doing these grunt jobs in this real space. The acting in Aliens, I'm going to say, doesn't always do that. The acting in Aliens often reminds you you're watching a movie. I'm talking about you, Bill Paxton. I'm talking about who's the other one that's not very good. But there's some of these. I mean, Ripley is still. But she's still in her own world. She's still doing it. Lance Henriksen.
He's got it.
Lance Henriksen is in the world of Alien that was created. But it does seem like a different universe. Paul Reiser, dear Lord in heaven. Okay, so. This shift into, but it worked still because we've become a comic book action movie. But again, my argument, there's no going back from that. And I'm disappointed because I think in going in that direction, they diminished the world in, you know, counter to like John Wick 2. I think they make the universe smaller because they decrease the possibilities of it from a storytelling standpoint at that point. That's the point that I was
absolutely
trying to make. Okay.
But I think this is, you know, James Cameron's pyrotechnic ego going off and saying, I can balance all three of these, even if there's very few other people that can.
Right.
And I don't think he cared about holding the franchise together. I think he was like, let's make this visceral, like that opening attack sequence with the everybody getting lost and all the aliens dropping from the ceiling. Was, you know, so in your face and so, you know, using the video camera thing with one of the very first movies to do that sort of thing. All of that, to me, was fantastic action.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, your defense for it is it's a great action movie. And
exactly.
I have no argument against that. I'm just saying I resent it.
The franchise.
I resent it.
Yeah. Okay. I resent a great action film. Okay. Yeah. Perhaps that's our next list. Great action films we resent.
Or great films we resent, just period. All right. My number nine is Casino Royale from director Martin Campbell, introducing Daniel Craig to the role. And one of the films that I was bringing up, I needed to have a Bond film in here. I mean, I just felt like if we didn't discuss Bond, I'm not sure this genre, of course the genre survives, but think about the 1970s. If you were watching an action film in the 1970s, you were watching an independent film, an exploitation film, a drive-in film. It is James Bond that turns action films into studio releases, into wide, big budget, nationwide studio releases. And not the first couple. It isn't until Goldfinger that it gets released into theaters. Before then, From Russia with Love and Dr. No are drive-in circuit films. One of those that I wanted to mention was From Russia with Love. This is a movie that holds up as, if not the best Bond film, then certainly one of the few of them. But I could not have it in good conscience on my list of the best action films because, again, it's not the action sequences. There's some that are cool, like when he's fighting the helicopter and the boat at the end and the mano-a-mano fight with Robert Shaw. These are cool, and you still can kind of get into them, but it's not the action sequences that make this film be still so scintillating. It's really the slow-boiling cat-and-mouse game, the espionage game, the psychological games at play. So that's what I meant when I talked about how sometimes, again, the it's the action sequences that keep some of these action films from being on the list, even though they're still wonderful movies. Casino Royale, it's hard to believe that the action sequences in that will do anything other than continue to make this film be a revelation generation after generation. You were describing how you like seeing the stunts, seeing practical effects, believing this is in the real world, having as much of it done in camera as possible. Casino Royale really pulls this off. Great.
Absolutely.
You believe that this man is a man of action, and by reintroducing James Bond as a young James Bond, we get to see how he discovers who he is through this action. It's a la like a Batman Begins, only if Batman Begins really knew how to do these action sequences. And they struggled with it somewhat. But Casino Royale really, really nails it. And it may be the best Bond film of all time.
Well, maybe, but my number, what are we at, eight?
Eight.
Number eight is Goldfinger, because I agree with you. You have to have a Bond film on this one. But I, for one, love Goldfinger for not only its fun time car chase in Las Vegas parking lots.
No, that's not. Car chase in Vegas parking lots. There's a car chase in Europe.
Forever.
Yeah, there's a car chase in Europe.
Right. But it's the Aston Martin with the injection seat that you got to love.
Which is fun, except that what's interesting about this film is how much of the action doesn't end fun, though. That's what's great about Goldfinger and the early Bond films. There's pain involved, right? Aston Martin, he doesn't get away. Tilly Masterson dies in the car, and he doesn't get away. So even though the car is fantastic and tricked out, he still gets captured in it. That's what's cool about that sequence. There's all these action sequences that end in failure.
Right. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
But to me, Goldfinger, though, you're right. Diamonds Are Forever. That's the way less action sequence. Anyway, the point is, Goldfinger's on my list. And I'm now going, holy shit, am I blending Diamonds Are Forever and Goldfinger in my head?
Well, they blended them intentionally. For some reasons, because they were trying to call back to the biggest hit of them all. I thought about Goldfinger, but again, there's a couple of sequences that just don't hold up for me action-wise, specifically action-wise, because of the technology of the time. I mean, the doing away with Goldfinger in the plane just feels a little cheesy to me. And it's, I watch the movie, again, for reasons other than the climactic action sequences. Although right. I do love the Odd Job mano a mano. That's pretty fun.
Exactly.
Shocking.
That's
shocking.
A good
villain. Positive and shocking. All right, right. Number 8 is a movie from the early 80s, nominated for several Academy Awards, even though it was made in the late 70s and could not get distribution for several years, despite the director renting out a theater in the Pacific Northwest and setting box office records for 2 years there. And it is the story of a convict who is a Vietnam veteran who has broken away from the law and is on the run, played by Steve Railsback, most famous for Helter Skelter. And he seeks refuge from the police on the set of an action movie being directed by Peter O'Toole, who would be nominated for an Academy Award for playing his imitation of David Lean. The movie is The Stuntman, and it makes us question everything we see in movies as to what is real and what is not in movies. It reveals the trick. It reveals that everything is a trick. It shows how everything is done, but you walk away, much like Steve Railsback does, wondering how much of what you see in real life is real. It's from director Richard Rush. It's The Stuntman. It is. It uses its action to blow your mind and to blow away your perceptions of reality. It's The Stuntman, number 8.
Right, and this one's so influential. It was like, I think they tried to make it a TV series type thing 3 different times now. The same concept, anyway, that stunts and special effects can blow people's minds so much that you can solve crime with it.
Yeah.
But I remember that, so... So, yeah, it was the first to have that, and I think that's a good one on your list.
Your number 7.
Mine is, of course, another Keanu Reeves favorite. It's The Matrix. Holy smokes, what action is this one? And not just nonstop. It's got, now again, this seems to be going against my very thing of don't make it all a digital overload because of, the world that he's in is a digital concoction. Spoiler alert. But for me, in terms of action revealing character and some of the innovation of it, and also the Zen metaphoric ending where you see through it and it all becomes, all the bullets will drop from the sky when you reach that space where you can see beyond the reality that is appearing before you. All of that makes Matrix my number 7.
I will talk about The Matrix
later.
In a little while. But why don't I... Yeah, I need to talk about it in a little while, but I will say that people sometimes ask whether, there ever could have been a movie version of The Prisoner. And I feel like The Matrix is the closest we ever want to come to a movie version of The Prisoner.
Interesting.
And I do love the philosophy of it. It is interesting because you can watch the sequels and learn everything that action movies should not be, and you can watch the original and see everything an action movie should be. But my number 7 is not unrelated. It's certainly a progenitor of The Matrix. It's the film that really introduced director John Woo and actor Chow Yun-fat to Western audiences, or the industrialized North, as more geographically accurate. And it's The Killer, and it's a Hong Kong film about an assassin being chased by a cop and the woman they both love, inspired by the Jean-Pierre Melville film Le Samurai, starring Alain Delon. And it reinterprets so many European modern archetypes and transfuses them into an entirely new way of filming action. It is, The Killer is to action of its era as The Wild Bunch was to its era. The ballet of violence. And it launched these careers. It could not have been more influential. The Killer, number 7.
Right.
What's your number 6,
Dean
Haglund?
Fantastic. Well, now that we're going overseas to films, let's look no further than Indonesia, and Gareth Hugh Evans written and directed The Raid, 2011. This is the story of some police that have to get a drug lord inside a high-rise apartment in the slums of Jakarta, and then suddenly the rookie and the other guy are trapped on the sixth floor, and the drug lord announces through the PA system that whoever kills them is granted free rent or something. And so the entire building comes out, and this is a martial arts action nonstop running for your lives, these two cops going through it. Some of the fight sequences in the hallways, going down the center well, unbelievable. They don't look like stuntmen. They look like they're martial arts guys that may or I don't know what the SAG safety rules are on set in Indonesia, but some of it looked like it really hurt.
I'm sure there's no such rules because it's not SAG in Indonesia.
Oh, we're not Global Rule One? I guess not.
We are if you're an American actor. It doesn't cover Indonesian actors. Yeah. American unions do not have authority over actors in other countries. Yes.
Okay, good. I see. Anyway, this thing just, I mean, it is full on, full paced action movie, and it spawned three sequels, and all of them just as much. The camera work is also really intense, you know? It's not a master shot and some close-ups. It seems that they go from sequence fight to sequence fight to sequence fight on a single, maybe one or two cameras catching it from alternate angles. So it seems maybe like it's just a single camera catching the fight as it's choreographed and unfolding throughout the entire building.
I have a film entry on number six. It's actually two films that are related, I think, both to the film that you just mentioned and to the mistake you just made about Screen Actors Guild. There is a movie star who became the biggest movie star in the world everywhere other than America after really failing to break through here and returning to his homeland. And one of the reasons that he could not become such a big movie star here was that he was never allowed to do his own stunts here. And when he was, the restrictions put upon him, you can choreograph the fight however you want, but you got to do it in sand, were to protect the other stuntmen and to ensure the insurance policy that they had. This actor could never get insured to do the stuff that he wanted to do. So Jackie Chan went back to Hong Kong. And two of his masterpieces, absolute action masterpieces that I have as a tie because they show the two sides of Jackie Chan. One is Police Story 3 Super Cop, third in the Police Story series, my favorite in the Police Story series. It introduces Michelle Yeoh to global audiences, who is every bit the action star equal of Jackie Chan, the only woman he has ever let do her own stunts in his movies because he knows she's as much of a badass as he is. And it's a contemporary cop thriller. The other one is also what we love of Jackie, which is the action comedy, where action sequences are expressions of comedy as much as they are of thrills. And that is Drunken Master 2, the big budget 1990s sequel to Drunken Master, a period piece where he has mastered the drunken style of kung fu. These set pieces are enormous. They are breathtaking. They are jaw-dropping. But the thing about Jackie Chan movies in Hong Kong, they never lose the big core at the center of them, which is Jackie Chan's humanity, his vulnerability, his humor, his compassion, his sense of love. Jackie Chan was, as everybody at the time might have said, well, he is to the rest of the world as Sylvester Stallone is to America. The truth is, he was to the rest of the world as Buster Keaton once had been to America.
Right.
That's who he was.
He had a lot of that same physicality.
And he patterned so many of the sequences after Buster Keaton movies. Actual gags in the movies would be patterned after it. He studied the silent films. He wanted to be a silent star, and it worked everywhere in the world except America. And we won't get into all the many reasons why. Okay, so that's my number six. What's your number five, Dean Haglund?
Well, my number five was the raid.
No, the raid was number six.
Six. Oh yeah. So my number five is, of course, now that I'm here down under, gotta appreciate George Miller's work, and it's his latest of the Mad Max ensembles. It's Mad Max Fury Road, with shot in one giant desert. And to my mind, it's off of the car chase, but it's amazingly choreographed and shot with such clarity that you never lose the multitude of characters that you have to follow. The number of cars that are blowing up and flipping around all seem practical. And that at no point is it shaky camera, quick spin pan arounds, that you are trying to catch up to try to figure out what's going on in the scene. Shot for shot, this thing storyboarded. I can't imagine what it was like for the actors and everybody in the 9 months of shooting in Namibia, I believe it was.
Namibia, there is no Namibia. Namibia.
Ah, you got me. The president, but he said there's Namibia.
On the new issue of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, On the Air, the podcast I do for the Breakfast Club, Lily each month does a report of what's upcoming at the club, and there's something related to Namibia. And I said, oh my God, you got it right. And she said, of course I got it right. And I said, a president who knows geography. And that's the closest we ever come to politics on the Breakfast Club
there
show.
We go.
Anyway,
yeah,
hilarious. A couple points here. You're so right about the geography. If we can call it that, on screen is always clear.
Yeah.
You always know where everyone is, what they're doing, where they are in relation to each other, and where we're going and where we've come from. You always understand this, which is so critical, because if you ever get lost in a movie like this for a minute, you're probably lost for good. It's because it's inundating you with sensation all the time. But it's also, at the same time, it is such a pleasing visual and auditory work of art. Lily said that she came out of it feeling like she'd just been in a 2-hour painting. And, it's really a work of art in that sense. I mean, yes, it's an art form and great films are a work of art, but she meant a real fine, piece of visual fine art. And another point that you've made, and we haven't brought it up on this, but you said years ago that really the future of action has to be women. And if you're making an action film and it's not a female protagonist, why are you even bothering? And if there had not been a Mad Max Fury Road, Aliens, just on that alone, would have been on my list, because Ripley is the modern template. But Mad Max Fury Road will appear on my list. And I think, Mad Max Fury Road, calling it that, is so interesting because, I've been talking about Buster Keaton a lot. Look at me, Mr. Silent Film, all of a sudden. But Mad Max Fury Road is the one where George Miller said, you know what this one is? It's Mad Max meets the General.
Oh, fantastic. That is so good.
So so that's your number five, Mad Max Fury Road. And my number five is The General from 1926.
We're all in agreement.
Directed by Buster Keaton and Clyde Bruckman. I imagine, does this show up on your list at some point?
It sure does.
Okay, so why don't you tell me why The General is such a great action film, and why, if anything, I've undervalued it at number five.
Well, I mean, it's a story of a single steam engine going through enemy territory in the Civil War, and that all of it, I mean, how many gags? Just think of it in the writing room. Okay, we got a steam train. What are we going to do? Okay, you're lost behind the enemy lines in the Civil War. Great. How many gags can you think off the top of your head? Three, maybe? This thing is 2 hours. Or no, how long does it run? An hour and 40, maybe? But all of it is the train's always moving. Buster Keaton's always either confused or lucky or something. And then such great freaking gag pieces, including the most amazing throwing of railroad ties to remove other railroad ties off the tracks from the front of the cowcatcher. There's no special effects around in the silent era that could have faked that. That is a single man who's very good at chucking huge pieces of lumber. And then, of course, the big spectacular ender, you know?
This was the first silent film I ever saw that made my jaw drop and made me go, oh, my Lord, they had mastered the medium. And then, of course, I go back and I watch all the other Buster Keatons. But this was not the first silent film I'd seen. But this is the silent film that becomes my entree into silent films. Because I'm just so, overwhelmed. Just so impressed. Now, let me ask you a behind-the-scenes X-Files question, if I may.
Okay.
So, spelled Clyde Bruckman, pronounced Clyde Brookman. The co-director for Buster Keaton on this, you were right, an hour and 47 minute long, action epic, the general, he would be the namesake for Peter Boyle's character in perhaps the greatest X-Files episode written by one of the Morgans, Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose. So clearly a doff of the cap to the great silent director and comedic director, Clyde Bruckman. I mean, think about some of the other people that Clyde Bruckman directed. He directed movies for not only Keaton, but W.C. Fields, Lauren Hardy, The Three Stooges, Abbott and Costello, and Harold Lloyd. So if you were funny and you did action set pieces, this was your guy.
Absolutely. And apparently he was quite a collaborator. So he wasn't just waiting for the comedic talent on camera to do something and then say, okay, that wasn't funny or that was funny. They would work together on gags, discuss them, figure them out, and then have the performer perform it and shoot it at the best angle so that the gag pays off in frame.
So when Darren Morgan writes Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose, do you know why he doffs his cap at this silent film director and why throughout that episode there are countless references to other silent filmmakers?
I don't know the answer other than Darren Morgan's breadth and width of intelligence and film history goes far and wide. So it's no mistake that that's the name of it and that was the references. But the reason why is, I think, just pure love of the genre.
Okay, good enough. All right, you're number four, Dean Haglund.
My number four, of course, is, you loved it as a kid. You have to have Spielberg on here somewhere. It's Raiders of the Lost Ark, 1984, if I'm not mistaken.
You are mistaken. It's 1981.
81? Oh, yeah, it came out on video in 84. That was the poster I had.
Temple of Doom. Temple of Doom is 84.
That's right. Raiders of the Lost Ark was 81. And, how often have I talked about the second unit brilliance of Steven Spielberg and how to shoot an experimental Nazi plane that's on fire with your heroine trapped inside, your protagonist beating up a giant then Nazi brute while the gasoline is leaking from the fuel truck and do it all in 3 minutes and 15 seconds. And that's just one of the many sequences that just keeps everything rolling along. And I love that movie. I still love it. I I'm not the biggest Spielberg fan as a director. But this thing is still a joy to watch today.
You know, this is the thing. You talked about things being practical effects, being done in camera, seeing real people do them, how much that helps believe the action and puts you in the action. But it also, in this case, because this whole movie was not a big-budget movie, they had to do as much of it as possible in camera. But it also gave an authenticity to the time and the place. It makes you really feel you're there. You know, whether it be South America or Europe or Egypt, this has a verisimilitude to it that makes it so much more exciting even. And then the other thing of the story, often the answer to how do you do it, we've created these big challenges for ourselves, the simplest answer will suffice and will be the best. You don't have to work harder all the time. Work smarter. Maybe the most famous incident, right in the film, after the big chasing after Marion in the laundry basket sequence through the streets of Cairo, and then suddenly all the crowds disperse and the giant swordsman appears. And
right.
He's exhausted and he has to fight him, and then he realizes he just doesn't have time for it, so he shoots him. And
right.
And where does that come out of? It comes out of the fact that they had an entire fight scene choreographed.
Right.
And they were running out of daylight.
And they, also,
they had one shot.
Harrison Ford was sick.
And he was sick. Yeah, they were behind schedule. And so, you know, the smartest answer might be the most exciting. So that's your number three, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
My number three, interestingly enough, for a long time, wasn't even my favorite of this film series. But in rewatching it maybe last year before Christmas, I really have come around to, look, this is the best of the series. This is a film that starts an entire subgenre of action films. It is one of the best action films of all time. It's John McTiernan's Die Hard 1988.
Right.
And
I agree with you.
He's an interesting character. He's a believable character. The action, as outrageous as it gets, is believable. It's bone-crunching. It's funny. It's human. The film's a delight from beginning to end, right down to the limo driver trapped in the parking garage for the whole time, not even knowing anything's going on.
Absolutely. That's a great point, too. And, you know, this is one of the movies where every dollar of that budget is seen on screen. You know, you hear so often that these bloated budgets, and then you go see the thing, you go, well, where'd all that money go? This one, with the tanks rolling up the stairs, all of that went to every aspect, every scene. Of course, the great villain with Alan Rickman, so good. And then Hans, of course. This one is on my list too.
It is. So I just said that was my number three, but I meant that was my number four. I'm sorry. Number four, because we just had done your number four, Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's my number four, Die Hard.
Right.
Even after the failure of that last one, the one set in Russia about A Good Day to Die Hard, that introduces his son, they are in fact making a sixth one, a prequel and a sequel called Die Hard Year One. About his first year as a cop, and Bruce Willis is back. So there will be a sixth one. The wait is over. So what is your number three, Dean Haglund?
Well, now here we go with something I saw at university, which a thing I love about action movies, and the thing I hated for a long time about action movies, was the violence. That the violence was mindless in so many of these things. And like you said, nobody seems to get hurt. That that every amazing sequence just happens effortlessly, and they get away with it, and all of that sort of thing. So then there's a movie that comes and undermines that, not just by putting together an action writer and a comedy writer to make a screenplay, but that the sequences are jarring when you watch it. In that there's a comedy segment, and then there's what seems to be brutal, brutal violence. And I'm talking about RoboCop. This, to me, was a revelation in action movies, because there is also the commentary on the Jarvis Sports Art, and I'll buy that for a dollar, and all the social commentary underneath all the action sequences that made it both satisfying as an action movie and undercut the whole action movie genre.
Well, I have at number three Mad Max Fury Road, and for some of the same reasons, because I think that it is a commentary on how our building up of bloodlust as filmmakers and then satisfying that bloodlust, you know, in the audience, what ramifications that has for culture, and how the exploitation of women in media, where that leads us. I think there is commentary on this throughout this movie. Just more reasons why Mad Max Fury Road is number three on my list of top 10 action films. That brings us to our top two. And if I'm not mistaken, you said that your number two is The General.
The General is correct. And think about just, I was just thinking about that final sequence. The train goes over a bridge that's on fire and collapses in a lake. And they shot that up in the Grapevine in California. I think that location's there. And so that had to be the last day of shooting because it's too bloody hard back in, what it was, in 1923, to drag an entire 30-ton steam train out of the water and do more shooting. So as far as I know, probably that train's still there in the riverbed.
My number two, you already discussed it. I spoke a little bit about it. It was your number seven film. It is The Matrix from the Wachowskis. Wow. And I would like to point out that the action is directed by Yuen-Woo Ping. And Western audiences definitely know him because he directs all the action in Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2.
And that was just below on my, that would have been my number 11 on this list.
And in Hong Kong, as a director, never mind a director of the action sequences, as the movie director, did at least two movies that are absolute masterpieces, movies I love, not just for the action, but they're great, great movies. And I encourage everyone to check them out. Wing Chun, and Iron Monkey. These are two of the best. Iron Monkey starring a very young Donnie Yen, who's still a very big star.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Yuen-Woo Ping, a true revolutionary in martial arts and in film action. So that brings us to our number ones. What is your top all-time action film, Dean Haglund?
Well, as you already discussed, it's Die Hard. My favorite, this thing just hums along. There's never a dull moment. And interestingly, it's set at a Christmas party because I think originally they thought this was going to be a Christmas release. And then it tested through the roof, as I heard from the executives at Fox, and they moved it to a summer release because they knew they had a winner on their hands. And so Die Hard, my favorite top action movie.
Now, I have other reasons why Die Hard finished a little bit lower. And why this one finished a little bit higher for me, because we have both of these, you and I, in our top four. But Die Hard finishes a little bit lower, and one of the reasons is because, as I said, it's responsible for creating a subgenre, but it was a subgenre where even bad filmmakers could make halfway decent movies.
Interesting.
Think about Steven Seagal in Under Siege, which is Die Hard on a boat, right?
Right.
We had, God, the most outrageous one I remember was Patrick Stewart and a young Vincent Kartheiser as a skateboarding high school student in Die Hard in a School called Masterminds.
I never saw that one.
Whereas Raiders of the Lost Ark changes everything for a very brief amount of time, where a lot of studios put money into trying to create Raiders-esque entertainment.
Right.
Tales of the Gold Monkey on television. Well, The Mummy is 16 years later. They finally managed to pull it off where a watered-down version of Raiders is okay. But right around then, the copies did not do well, like Tales of the Gold Monkey. Or dusting off the old Alan Quartermain character, you know, and doing King Solomon's Mines with Richard Chamberlain. And what they found was, wow, you really need good filmmakers to pull these ones off. And
absolutely,
even good filmmakers might not pull it off, a la some of the Indiana Jones movies.
Right. Well, I think they stepped away from the 1930s serials that clearly Spielberg loved because, to my mind, not only was it set in the 30s, the filmmaking itself was in the style of the 1930s filmmaking. So it had that retro feel across the board, all the way down from a Nazi looking over the newspaper with wire rimmed glasses to one side suspiciously. Like, all of those details in there were missing in so many of the other sequels.
I mean, the Temple of Doom, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, a sequel that I think has always been given short shrift. I always applauded Steven Spielberg for when he makes a sequel, which is a prequel, he changes things completely tonally. He does not try to copy himself. He moves it in an entirely different direction, a dark direction, a scary direction. Later, he apologizes for it. But that's just another reason to hate him. But the fact that he did in the first place is one of the few things to admire about him. But Raiders of the Lost Ark, taking almost its cue from, movies like Casablanca, but also something Hitchcock really mastered. And there are visual, by the way, visual signatures that directly nod to the influence Casablanca had. What I love about it is it's a movie that moves so fast that you never are given a chance to question, and you're so entertained that you never want to question the logic of anything. And this is what Hitchcock always referred to when talking about the MacGuffin, right? The MacGuffin doesn't matter. The Ark of the Covenant doesn't matter. Indeed, it gets locked up at the end and never to be seen again.
Right.
Adventure is what matters. And if you're asked, if you stop long enough to start to ask questions about it, well, that means the movie is no longer working. Like the letters of transit that cannot be rescinded by even Charles de Gaulle himself in Casablanca. Wait a minute, why can't they be? Charles de Gaulle's a puppet of the Vichy. Why can't they be?
Yeah, right.
They could be stopped. But you never stop to ask that because you're just having too good of a time. And Raiders of the Lost Ark is a masterful exemplar of this. And at the same time, I think, a la Star Trek, this is a movie that introduces a whole generation to a field of study that would influence the rest of their lives. It's ridiculous to say that you're coming to Raiders of the Lost Ark for the archaeology lesson, but it's not ridiculous to believe that many people discovered their love of archaeology and studying archaeology because they were so inspired by Indiana Jones.
Wow. Well, there you go.
That's our top 10. All-time action films, we got that in almost under 60 minutes. You can find every installment of your Chillpack Hollywood at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Write a review if you want.
What could be more fun?
Follow us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. You can write us there and stream and do all the things.
Please write us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Our email address, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram.
We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
What could be more excited? We another very special episode, an odd episode. I've been promised that it will include hilarious audio from Sydney, Australia's now defunct but never forgotten Hilarium.
Just slightly, we're a pop-up that pops up from time to time. That's all.
Until then, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Agnew. See ya.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. Now intercontinental, LA to Australia.
Belated spoiler alert.